Welcome to the Leader, Manager, Coach podcast, where we share knowledge, philosophies, wisdom, and insight to help you on your journey in both sport and life. Introducing your host, Rob Riles.
Hello and welcome to the Leader Manager Coach podcast. Welcome along. It's Rob Riles welcoming you to another edition. Now, in today's program, I'm going to chat to somebody that I know extremely well, and I'm delighted to be able to bring to you. And I shall tell you all about it in a minute. But before I reveal the name of the lady, I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. Maybe she'll put me right if any of this is wrong. But the lady I'm speaking to is called Amanda. She is an eminent and successful businesswoman, and she is an expert in the field of customer loyalty. In 2023, Amanda was awarded a prestigious International Loyalty Personality of the Year Award for her work and services in the industry. She is a Loyalty Awards judge, an experienced airline and retail executive. She is the founder and CEO of Truth, a leading global loyalty consultancy. She's also a media celebrity, a keynote speaker, and an author. And she was educated in the UK at Loughborough University, where she was a very competitive tennis and netball player. And she continues her sporting journey, being an established Ironman triathlete and ultra marathon runner, somebody who has completed numerous 90K Comrades ultra marathon events in her beloved South Africa. Amanda recently suffered the loss of sight in her right eye and subsequently set up her blind loyalty trust to help others who suffer with similar conditions. She also has a favorite contribution cause in addition to that, which is the AAMI Foundation, who offer programs which develop and empower youngsters from challenged and vulnerable communities in South Africa. Amanda lives in Cape Town, and she spends her free time with her amazing three children and husband, Theo. And the lady in question is Amanda Cramout, and she happens to be also my sister. And I make no bones about being happy that she's on. So, Amanda, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, wonderful. So special to be here. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for the introduction.
So for anybody who's listening, this isn't just about me filling my boots with chatting to my family. Amanda has all the qualities that we tend to migrate towards on Leader, Manager, Coach, and you'll find out as we go on, hopefully. But I want to ask her a few things. We could start anywhere, but I'm going to start with one thing that is synonymous with Mand, and that is a little quote that goes something like, if it doesn't scare you, it's probably not worth doing. So that's about sums you up, Mand, yeah?
Yeah, so I can't take credit for that quote. It was given to me by a gentleman called David Noyes. He was a senior executive in British Airways when I was a less senior executive. And I went to ask his advice whether I should take one role or the other. And all he said was, which one scares you? And it was clear one of them really scared me, which was to come to South Africa to lead the British Airways South Africa team. And he went, well, there you go. If it doesn't scare you, it's not worth doing. And I just think it's magic. And I use it all the time with my kids. And I hope they take it in. Sometimes they want to ignore me because not everyone wants to take the harder route. But it's true, right? If it doesn't scare you, then maybe it's a little bit too easy and it's just too much in our comfort zones. But, you know, some days maybe we need the love and comfort of a comfort zone, but other days we don't. And it's the genius in all of us that lacks some days, or is there other days, is to find which days you need to push that comfort zone and which days you sit comfortably within it.
Yeah, so there's always a balance, isn't there? Because being autobiographical, last night I had a guilt trip because I came home, I had a bar of chocolate and I went to bed early because I had no energy. And you know what? I had to deal with myself because I'm thinking, you know what? This isn't the hero's journey. This is like, you know, but you're right. Sometimes you've got nothing left, and it's finding the right balance. So, look, you've certainly engaged in things that are scary, Mand, in your life. I mean, it's hard to know where to start, but let's try and start at the beginning. Obviously, being siblings, we have a lot in common. What do you think are the things that you had from your childhood that influenced what you've done in your life, good or bad?
You're on the spot, brother. Okay, so I think I was very privileged to grow up around my three brothers, and I'm not just saying that, this isn't a self sort of gratification discussion, because as a younger sister, you have no like sympathy anywhere from your brothers. It's like, get on with it, be mm-hmm. one of the lads and get on with it. And our parents were just remarkable parents of that era. They just let us get on with it. They weren't mollycoddling us like I think most parents do today. And we got on with it, and it made us tough as nails. And I often talk to my kids around something called Northern grit. So whilst we're from Stoke-on-Trent, we're not in the north of England, but I always remember I had the privilege of going to boarding school for my sixth form, which I did on a tennis scholarship, and netball, actually. I enjoyed netball there more than tennis. And I always remember the coach just taking me aside going, wow, you got Northern grit. And I think it's just grit, you know, like there's times when folks will stand up to grit, stand up and pull on that grit. And there's times when others will just go, it's just too hard. And I think if you see the success at the end of that grind, it makes it worthwhile next time when you question whether you're prepared to put in the effort. And I'm not going to take away the opportunity I had. You know, I'm not going to undermine the opportunity I had. I went to Millfield, which is an exceptional place. I went on a scholarship, as I say, for tennis. And during my holidays there, rather than like chill out in the summer holidays, I did stupid things like they had an expedition to the Northern Himalayas to climb the Himalayas. I had never worn a pair of walking shoes. And I remember going to the interview, I was on crutches because I broke my ankle playing football, actually. I was playing football for charity and this lad kicked me in the ankle and I broke my foot, missed the final England trial that I was up for. So my coach was really pissed off with me. And then I turned up to this interview on crutches to climb the Himalayas. And this guy just went, what are you doing? And I said, I just know I can do it. Let's get on with it. And he went, I love it. Let's do it. And I was part of this expedition and we climbed the Himalayas up to 20,000 feet. And then the following summer, I went on a 3-month sail training ship, all self-funded. Like mum and dad didn't dig into their pockets for it because they couldn't. So I raised the cash. And I remember turning up and they said, so what sailing history have you got? And I said, absolutely none. Yeah. And they just laughed and they said, okay, so how can you do it? And I said, because if you don't try, you're never going to get on with it. And I honestly can't answer your question too deeply because I don't know where that came from other than Northern grit. And that kind of those two episodes as a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old in my gap year almost epitomize what I think, if it doesn't scare you, it's not worth doing, means, because I came out of both of those going, that was a life-changing experience. And that, yeah. I think about that frequently when I sign up for Comrades, which is the ultimate human race. You know, that is not easy, and that scares me every time I'm on the start line, but it's worth doing. But if it was easy, everyone would do it, and then it wouldn't be special.
Three great examples. And anybody who listens to that who hasn't had the opportunity to go to the Himalayas nor hasn't had the opportunity to sail, you know, not around the world, but you know, sail for 3 months and all the rest of it, will say, yeah, privilege, yeah, all that. But what we're looking at there are the lessons that led up to that. How many people in that situation would go, oh no, I broke my ankle, end of chat, can't get on with it, never sailed before, so you know, it's not going to be for me. So as you say, it's forging experiences, and it's how you look at it. So
And actually, Rob, interesting, on both the climbing the Himalayas and the sail training, trust me, during those experiences, because I was 17 and 18, I had weeks of regretting it, weeks in the middle of it going, why have I done this? Like, I'm at altitude, I can't breathe, or I'm freezing cold and the food is disgusting, and sailing, I was seasick for 3 weeks solid. Like, it's not a pleasant experience. No. But you kind of, for whatever reason, and I think those are the things you push through. And I was safe as you can be in a place like the Himalayas or on a boat. And look, if you look back now, you can't even go to Kashmir. It's not politically safe or stable to go. So thank goodness I did it when I could. But back to your point about privilege, I mean, you know, our parents we're not from a wealthy background. So every penny was raised, which in a sense now gives you the ability to go, you can actually do anything if you can put your mind to it, appealing to the press, the local Stoke-on-Trent press to cover it, and local Stoke-on-Trent companies sponsored both of those events, and you make money by working three shifts a day, and Yeah, you can get there. And I wish the young, I don't want to be generational about this, but sometimes I want to say to the younger generations, like, if there's a will, there's a way. I don't care what it is. There is always a way. Don't be put off. Don't think you can't afford to go to university if that's a barrier. Don't think you can't do that experience, because you can do 3 working shifts for a few months if you want it enough.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely, man. And, you know, three, as I say, three formative kind of experiences that you're taking something out. Yeah, and listen, how you're brought up forms your vision of the world. You know, I remember going to school, like, and I was getting myself dressed, goodness knows, because teachers used to say to me, like, you know, you wear that every day. And I think, what they're on about, like, but no, but I can't ever remember getting taught to get, you know, I used to, you did, we did it ourselves, didn't we? We did, you know, and independence was like the buzzword, otherwise you're going to sink, you know? So,
yeah, absolutely.
Just little things like that. So, look, I know when you left uni that you had a long and successful career as I'll say the word executive, and you can put me right on that. And when you work for one of the most eminent companies in the UK, the British Airways. So tell us a little bit about that, because not everybody's worked for British Airways, and not everybody's done what you did in the company. So there must be some value in investigating that on your journey and what you got out of it, and how you look back on it now, Mand.
Yeah, so it was a really amazing 11 years career. Like, I remember being at university, and I remember doing a business course where I did they called it a sandwich year at university. So I went off and lived in France because I was doing business studies in French, lived as this student, like two of us in a room smaller than my current bathroom kind of thing. Like, we just digged in Paris. What an experience. And we had absolutely no money. We just worked our butts off and spoke French, and it helped us in our final year. And then I remember saying, I don't know if you remember the milk round, but that used to be like all the corporate career companies used to come around, or big institutions, and come around and try and motivate you to join them post-university. So that doesn't seem to exist elsewhere in the world in the same way. And I don't know if it still exists in the UK, but I remember the milk round, and I remember Mars Company and GM and three, like, loads of huge great companies, and British Airways used to do it. And I remember saying there and then, there's only one company I want to work for, and it's British Airways. I don't know why. I knew early, and I know not everyone has this in the career. I knew early what I wanted to do. I always wanted to be in business, and I was lucky enough to secure a place on their graduate marketing program. And there were 15 of us, and it was a 4-year program. But what was so special about it is they immediately chucked you in at the deep end. So it was proper corporate training. It was comfort zone stuff, presentation skills. One of the best skills they ever gave me was when I was country manager in South Africa, they gave me Sky News trained media training. In case an aircraft ever went down, you had to be the person on Sky News dealing with it. And that was like immense training, you can imagine, because it's panic zone, it's chaos. And that today, even today, like in the work I do, that training has helped me enormously. But what I do remember most about it is, within the first 6 weeks, I had the opportunity just to go and do the craziest projects, which if you aren't prepared to shove yourself out there, you couldn't do it. So some of us, there were 15 of us, some of the crowd would have gone for the, no, I'll stay at home and I'll just do this project. And some of us put our hands up, and a lot of folks on that course were like me and said, send me as far as you can. I want to do the cool stuff. And then I do remember the second proper job I had was country manager in Malawi for British Airways. And the irony is BA had one flight a week. So people used to say, like, what the hell do you do all week? Like, there's only one flight. But you did everything. Like, you were trained to be what's called a load controller, which has equal legal liability for that flight taking off as a captain. I was trained to be a reservations agent. I was trained to meet the government and negotiate the trading terms between Britain and Malawi. So it was just the most immense experience. And I remember phoning Dad when I got offered this job, and I went, Dad, I've got this job in Malawi. Where's Malawi? And I'd accepted a job. I didn't actually properly know where it was. It was ridiculous. I knew it was somewhere in Africa. And I took this, and it was just the most special experience of my life. It was like, go in there and do what you got to do, learn everything from dealing with government, dealing with upset passengers when an aircraft has gone technical and no one's got anywhere to go to sleep because the aircraft's stuck, to learning to work with your team, like leading a team of young or old individuals who may have worked for the airline their whole life, and in comes a 25-year-old from London. What the hell does she know? It was a really humbling yet growing and inspirational experience. And that was Malawi. And then luckily, because of that, I went on to other roles. And the reason we laugh about Malawi, because it was one flight a week, I think the organization, IEBA, used to send in graduates, because if you really stuff it up, how bad can it be? Like, it's one flight a week. It's not like 20 flights a day. So it's a safe training ground, and that's what it was. And then I did go on to then do, at a very young age, general manager of South Africa, which was sort of like almost the highlight of my career with BA. And that was a significant station because that was like the fifth most profitable route for the airline. But that was after I'd grown a little bit and taken all those learnings. And hence my affiliation with South Africa, because I met Thee, my husband, and then eventually came back here to live. But yeah, all credit to British Airways. I have nothing but fond memories of working for that company. It taught me so much about leadership. And again, that quote, if it doesn't scare you, it's not worth doing. I mean, I didn't know where the hell Malawi was, but you just chuck your name in the hat and off you go.
Yeah, so the thing that stands out, Amanda, and I try and enjoy the stories of everybody that's on the podcast, because that's where the glory comes from. That's where the great stuff, we all get taught by stories. Well, the messages that stand out for me are like, just you had the opportunity and the choice to jump in, which carries on from the expeditions and it's like getting at the deep end and do your learning and sink or swim. And that's what stands out. Give it a go, you know, what the heck?
I think we all like try and encourage our kids in our own ethos in life, but as we know, our kids are our kids and they will take their own journey in life. But I do encourage, like, just run towards everything, even if that means you stop because you've learned on the way that that's not for you. Just run towards it. It doesn't matter how bad the news is.
Yeah.
It's not going to disappear. If it's bad news, it's not going to disappear. You've got to handle it. So, you know, so many of us hear bad news and want to run away, but bad news doesn't disappear. You've got to run towards it. You've got to handle shit, you know, so you can't. I think that's a big thing. And I think, you know, our mum taught a lot about that. Like, it's like you work hard, you know, I think we have very different parents, and dad's got this very gentle and beautiful relationship approach to life, which I hope I take a lot from if I can. And mum's got this sheer guts and determination, which I think I've definitely taken a big spoonful. And hopefully the combination of the two can help us in our journey in life. Mm. We don't always get it right. Sometimes we get the combination of the two very different, you know, in the wrong percentages, and it doesn't get the right result.
But yeah, 100%. Yeah,
100%.
No, I can recognize that. And it's a good point. It's going back to that balance issue of, look, if you're at the bottom end of your energy levels and you're on a 1 out of 10, today's not the day to start your new business or have that difficult conversation. But, you know, like you say, I can hold my hand up and say, I probably definitely recognize the tendency to be perfectionist and spend too much time preparing and reading and making sure I'm all 100% before I kind of jump into it, instead of giving it a go, getting dirty and learning that way. So, I'm not saying be unprepared, but it's a balance, yeah.
Yeah, and I think as I've got older, I'm a little bit more of the latter. I do, like, wing it a lot, which isn't always great. There's times when I afterwards regret it, that I could have done better, I could have served our clients better, or I could have helped my kids better, or, you know, so I do tend, and maybe that's just because the mass volume of stuff we're dealing with every day, whether it's work, private, personal, sometimes I feel I end up having to wing life way too much, and sometimes you can get away with it, and it's a fine balance to know that. And if you don't get it right, to stop and self-reflect. You know, I always say to myself, like, when I clean my teeth tonight, will I think I've done the best I could do? And like you mentioned about your chocolate bar, like, trust me, I have a million nights when you just, like, it all falls down and you just kind of go, give me a glass of wine and a bar of chocolate, rather than
start again tomorrow.
Start again tomorrow, and that's okay. it's okay. It's just not okay if that's every night, right? And it is okay. And actually, Han, who you know well, your niece and my daughter, she said, Mum, one of the things that she's really trying to get is, she said, Mum, you allow yourself to fall down, or you allow yourself to have those moments where you don't carry, but you don't then necessarily carry the guilt for days. And I think that's just a bit of 52 years behind us rather than 18 years.
No, 100%. So, I mean, the more the more we look, well, the more I look into stuff, it's all about, people say it's not just turning up. A lot of it's turning up and doing your best. And then, you know, learning from that, and, you know, Pelé and some of the stories behind the greats, the people, what we consider to be the greats who have achieved high stuff. It's the backstories where all that detail exists, and nobody's got these free rapid rises to whatever it is they want. It just does not happen. And you know, the greatest baseball players, you know, there's the greatest cricketers, the greatest Michael Jordan, let's pull him out there. He's something like three times as many missed shots as scores, you know? So like, he's only 30% successful. So 66% of the time he's wrong, yet he's the greatest there is, you know? So it's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, the business I'm running now has had a really good year because of this recognition from the International Loyalty Awards. And it's just almost like it's all come together nicely, just timing, right? So someone said to me the other day, like, flipping heck, it sounds like an overnight success. And I just laughed. It's exactly what you just said. I went, I have been slogging at this for 13 years at this company, let alone what I've done before. And for 13 years, there's been times when I've wondered if there's cash flow to pay salaries, or have I got clients coming in, or will anyone really take me seriously? Or so I think no matter what it is, and please, I'm not comparing myself to the greats, far, far from it. Whatever your thing is, whatever your business or, you know, your sport or whatever it is in life is, if it does come overnight with no work, then that's not sustainable. You know, so I always say, if you've got incredible talent and you suddenly win big because of your talent, you're going to come down fast and furious, faster than you believe it, because you haven't actually learned the ethics of hard work and determination and how to pick yourself up when it's tough. Because the folks who get it easy, they will either learn quickly and work hard and carry on doing well, or they're going to fall hard and it's going to hurt more than maybe folks who didn't get it so easy. And I really feel strongly about this, that no one in the world is an overnight success. I remember reading Madonna's bio, and she said people thought I was an overnight success after 10 years of almost having to be a strip artist in a New York nightclub. You know, that's not fun. Like, it wasn't fun. But suddenly she got the break she needed. And you hear it about all the rock stars and I think the best sports people.
100%. 100%. So it's a good time to move from that then onto truth, because you've already started to tell us a little bit about that. And look, if I could, you know, I'm not jealous of you in any single way, man, but truth is the best business name that I've ever heard. It's just the best. It's just because the truth sets you free, as hard as it is. So how did you pick up that name to start with? It's a good question.
Oh, it's a beautiful story, actually. It's a great story. And yeah, the number of people who've asked me if they could buy the URL, or when I email and they go, wow, your email address is amazing, because it is truth. It's not truth loyalty, it's truth. So Theo's my husband, and I were on holiday just after we got married in Mexico, because I worked for the airline. We used to zoop off all over the place. And we're sitting on a beach in Zihuatanejo. Now, what's the significance of Zihuatanejo? You should know. The Shawshank Redemption. That's the beach where they end up on the back of that boat in that legendary movie.
I'm rubbish on films, but yeah.
So we're sitting there and we're drinking a cold Carenza, a cold beer. And Thee said to me, okay, so what job do you want to do when you leave British Airways? I was in the midst of British Airways. And I said, I don't know, but I just know I want to run my own business. And we sat there that day and we came up with the name Truth. We came back to England and I went online and I bought the URL for 200 quid. Someone owned it, and they owned it because they had a project name called Truth. And I sat on it for about 5 years until Truth was even came Brilliant. Up as a business. I didn't even know what the business was going to be, but I just knew it was right. So it's truth.co.za. It's not .com, unfortunately. But locally, there's quite a few companies. There's a couple of other companies who are like Truth Coffee or Truth This, and they've all approached us wanting to buy.
That's great.
There's Truth TV, actually. They've all approached us. We get all sorts of phone calls in our office about my subscription to Truth TV is broken. Can you help? And I'm like, no, it's nothing to do with me. Can I order some coffee? No, nothing to do with me. But yeah, it's a great URL. And actually, if you're in the world of loyalty, you know, like if you're not telling the truth, your customers won't trust you. So we really can't, we don't play on the word, but naturally it comes up all the time. So yeah, I'm very aware it's a fantastic URL, and I'm very happy Thea and I had that cold beer on Ziwatanehu many years ago.
Yeah, it's a great story. And it is the name. It is just, yeah, you know, I don't know what to say about it, but yeah, you wouldn't have the inquiries if it wasn't that. I mean, okay, so loyalty. I don't think there are many people who think, oh, I'm going to be a loyalty expert. I just don't think that's,
career,
I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a footballer, I want to be a train driver, I want to be a rock star, I want to be an accountant, whatever it is. I want to be a horticulturalist, I want my own farm, whatever. But not many people are going to say, oh, I want to be a loyalty expert. So how did that evolve, or how did that come to be? Because you're obviously... and let's not beat about the bush, highly successful at it. You know the industry, you're recognized for your work, you know, you're a leading light. I mean, isn't it? Let's not hide under the bushel. Where did that come from?
So I always knew I wanted to be in business, and I always knew I loved marketing. And then I got on the British Airways graduate marketing program. So I was very clear. I think I'd seen when I was really young, like a Chanel advert with this beautiful woman walking into a boardroom with long blonde hair and a suit on. I don't have blonde hair, and I certainly didn't look like that lady. But I joined British Airways. Now, the airlines are the sort of founders of loyalty from the frequent flyer programs. So back in the days when American Airlines started in the 1980s. I mean, if you remember, I mean, maybe we'll chat later about a book I've just written, but I talk about when we used to go with Dad to the Shell garage, and he used to get the stamps filled up, and we'd walk away with Coca-Cola glasses. That's loyalty, right? So it's a campaign, but it's loyalty at the end of the day, because he went to Shell instead of somewhere else. So I was never a loyalty expert, and I was never, didn't wake up one day and become, say, I want to do loyalty. But the training I got at BA, because FFP, frequent flyer programs, are so dominant in the loyalty, in the airline environment, I just naturally did that kind of work in the airline. And a lot of the projects I worked on, a lot of the jobs I did, were in that part of marketing rather than advertising, for argument's sake. I never worked on the advertising marketing side. I'm also very mathematical. So I did I did A-level maths, and it was my best A-level result out of the three. And then at university, I did broader business, but always enjoyed more of the math side. And loyalty marketing is very to do it well, it's very much about data and segmentation and understanding customer from their behavioral stuff, which comes from data, without crossing the boundaries of sort of privacy and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I'm not into the pretty pictures side of marketing, and those who are, I've got massive respect for, because it's a creative art. This is more the science of marketing, and definitely plays to my strengths. And I just fell into it. And then I left BA, worked a bit in South Africa on other projects, and then ended up being head of loyalty for Woolworths South Africa, which is like a Marks and Spencers in the UK, a very top-end retailer. And I was head of their customer division, which was loyalty and all the stuff that goes with it. And that's really where I sort of started to specialize. And then I realized there that corporate life was kind of coming to an end for me. I just realized I needed to move on. And realized that the market had very little expertise. So I just went deep into it. And I've also learned, find your skill and be deep, and go as deep as you can and niche as you can in it. I did generalist marketing consultancy, and the world and his dog can do it. But to be deeply, deeply in an industry and niche, unashamedly niche in something, is much more powerful. I do get phone calls that say, can you help us on our marketing strategy? And I say, no, but I can find you someone who can. I mean, I probably could help out if I really applied myself, but that isn't what we do, and that isn't what we're experts at. There's lots of really good people who could do it instead of me.
Yeah, that's right. And again, Manda, it sounds like an evolution, a lot of learning. The lessons that stand out, or one of the lessons that stands out in that for anybody who's listening, is that recognition that something's coming to an end, that boredom, that it's not doing it anymore, it's not floating my boat, I'm treading water, and the need to challenge yourself and move away from a corporate salary and risk not having pounds coming in at the or dollars or quatcha or whatever it is, and then taking that risk, which is where
I remember Rob, one of the biggest learnings, it was the hardest year of my life, was leaving that corporate label, because I'd worked for incredible companies. So globally, if you say you work for British Airways, it meant something. Like, I could go into any room in the travel industry and say, hey, I'm the general manager of British Airways. People didn't actually really care what my name was. You were the general manager of British Airways.
Yeah.
When I was at Woolworths, Woolworths is a massive brand in South Africa, the most premium retailer here. I could walk anywhere and go, and you tell people you work for Woolworths, and they're like, wow, what a great company. And then suddenly I lose the shackles of both of those. And I was like, I'm Amanda. Shit, who's Amanda? And I remember it was a year of real fear. And then I'll never forget working with a friend who helped me create the first website and the first business card. And he went, so what's your elevator pitch? And how much are you going to charge per hour? And the first client I worked with, it was a remarkable man called Mike. And he just said, I'm not going to say the company. And I pitched my work and I gave him a quote. And he said, I'll take your quote as long as you add a zero to it. He just said, you've done work for me before. He says, this is ridiculous. I was so timid and so uncertain and just so undervalued and so happy to get the work. And he just said, I'll take your quote and you'll do what you say you'll do, but just add a zero and send it back to me. Yeah. And I remember just bursting into tears going, I can't do that. And I've come to the realization that you'll find your worth when you've got the experience. You can't find that on day one, and you've got to learn those lessons. And then you don't undervalue yourself. You've got to have the guts sometimes to walk away from business if you feel it's undervaluing.
And that powerful word called no, that can take, if you don't get good at saying that for millions of reasons, can lead you to hell if you don't.
Are you struggling to find that extra edge to help you stand out above the crowd? Separating yourself from the rest is often about personal leadership. Achieve your true potential and become who you really can be. The Leader Manager Coach Pro Course is a unique membership accessing the knowledge and wisdom from history's greats that will help you develop both personally and professionally to make you truly stand out. The Leader Manager Coach Pro Course. Access now at patreon.com. Leader Manager Coach.
So here you are. Let's say you've reached, might not be your top of the tree, but you've certainly hit a mark with your award, Mandan. Obviously, you've achieved a level of success, and in your business, in with Truth as CEO. And so what everybody else will want to know is, okay, so you've not just dropped out of corporate world and suddenly had this successful business. Tell us about a time that made you cry with tears, that you're thinking, this ain't going to work. I've made a mistake here. This ain't working, or something's going wrong. What's the biggest challenge you've had?
I think the biggest challenge of running your own business, and you and I have talked about this before, is you end up working in the business. So you become in my case, a loyalty consultant. You don't put enough time at working on the business, like growing the business so that the cash flow is right, so that you employ someone if you need to, or you look for the next client. So my early days were very much that. I was the consultant and running the business, and I might have had one person supporting me. And the scariest time was when I ran out of cash. There was one time I properly ran out of cash, because the cash flow, because I don't know what it's like internationally, but certainly in this market, corporates can take 90 days to pay you. So you bill them on the 1st of, say, April, you do the work in April, and you don't actually get paid till April, May, June, till 1st of July. But you've paid your salaries, you've paid yourself, hopefully, because you've got school fees to pay. And I probably ran out of cash. And I remember just going, I just don't know where I'm going to get the money from. I'm kind of reaching into a UK bank account that I'd had some savings from a student and tried to hope the exchange rate helped. So that was the scariest time when I thought, you know, maybe I should just go back into corporate. It's a lot easier to have a corporate salary and I was good at it. And yeah, maybe I should go back into corporate. And I will never forget the day when, and what kind of stopped me going back into corporate, I'll never forget the day when I did actually leave corporate life, telling Hannah at the time, she was 4 years old, I think, or 6 years old. I drove her home from play school or wherever. And I said, Mummy's leaving work. I'm going to work for myself. And she just burst into tears with happiness. Because, you know, at that age, the kids just want you to be available, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that now I work harder than I ever worked before is irrelevant. Like, I'm less available than I ever was. But, you know, if I want to pop out and pick up my kid, I just put it in my diary and I just work an hour later. So that experience of being a working mum is remarkable, that I can do that. Like, if my kid's doing something I need to be at, I'll be at it if I can, and I can plan it and work around it. And you can, as you said, the power of the word no. I can say no to people. I can say, I can't do that day, I can do tomorrow. So yeah, it was scary, Rob, at times, but fortunately it hasn't been over the 13 years to what takes it today. I only really had one or two of those major down patches. We've been very lucky. We've created a reputation that's kept it. Now the team grew. I grew the business. I did sell part of the business. I went through a buyout, which at the time felt right. And then it wasn't right. And then during COVID, just business structures changed so that it meant I could buy the business back. And now I'm my own shareholder, my own manager again, which is how I prefer it. But having said that, I learned an awful lot in that buyout process. I smartened up the business. I started to do business planning better because you've got shareholders. Suddenly you've got a board to report to. So whilst I don't report to a board because I kind of report to myself, I do think differently, which was a great learning experience. And I do plan differently, and I've learned cash flow principles better. And, you know, I've kind of take things a bit more seriously, and it's a bit more grown up in how we run the business.
So if it's not a silly question, I know this isn't a loyalty podcast, but I think people are interested in how people think and they plan and how they see their future success. So where's Truth going from here?
So the consultancy will carry on, which is what I've been doing for 13 years. So you'd think I'd get bored of it by now, but I'm not, because we have the best clients ever. Like, sometimes we're dealing with big corporate banks and big corporate retailers. And then I'll get a phone call from a pesticide farmer in Cameroon. And you're like, what the heck has loyalty got to do with that? But he wants to incentivize the guys who sell the pesticide, right? So it then becomes a B2B loyalty program. Or we get Italian water pumps want to learn about loyalty. We get the best calls, typically on a Friday, interestingly. And I find every project is as interesting as the other one, because like now we're working with a TV channel or a football club, and like it's so different and it's so exciting, and the people I meet are typically awesome people. So I love the consultancy, but it's not sustainable to just do that. So the future of Truth is very much in our training programs. We have three incredible training programs online, which have served like over 800, you know, not quite 800, like over 600 people around the world in 20 different countries already. And the plan is to scale that globally. So I've got a few partners I'm talking to who want to take it and create a partnership. We create the content. Why do we create the content? Because we're deep experts at loyalty. So the target audience are either individuals running a little loyalty program or a massive loyalty program, or interestingly, the companies who serve the loyalty industry. So all the tech companies and data companies who just speak tech and don't really understand how to speak loyalty. So the point there is to say, this course is cost effective. It's easy, not easy to do because the content's easy, but easy channel. And it's the best way to get you and your team upskilled. And that's the plan, is to scale that globally, because we've half scaled it. We've played around internationally, but now we are super determined to serve the loyalty world through brilliant training, because it's really good training. I've got fantastic feedback. It's internationally accredited. So that's the plan, but we can't do that unless we're brilliant consultants. So the consultancy work must carry on. And what I am loving about the work we're doing is we are bringing together an industry. So we started off bringing together the South African industry. So we run conferences and white papers we write that become the national loyalty white paper. So we brought together the South African loyalty industry without being an official South African loyalty body, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And now I think with this very privileged sort of recognition I've had this year, plus the trust, which I can mention to you in a moment, I'm finding an energy where I'm helping to bring parts of the global loyalty industry together, which is really exciting. I've got calls from people saying, how do we support the trust? How do we do these things together? Which is really fabulous, because actually together, everyone's better, right? Even if you're competitors, in my view, there's no such thing as, I mean, there's dirty competition where you're at each other's throats, and then there's healthy competition, and actually healthy competition is better for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I just seen this thing the other day where there's a Coke machine. They were vending about 100 cans of Coke a day. And then the bloke came in who serviced the machine, and next to it, they'd put a Pepsi machine. So he was absolutely devastated. So he went to them and said, and they said, well, we're just giving our people choice. It turned out the month after, they were selling 200 cans of Coke, and he assumed Pepsi
Same
stayed
Pepsi
there. So
whatever.
Like it just gone up like doubled because there was competition. Like, wow. Eh?
Yeah, it's amazing. And I can believe it. Yeah, totally. Totally.
And he said that, not that I know, he said the reason is because the internal dialogue goes something like, do I want a drink? Yes or no. Or what do I want, Pepsi or do I want Coke? Not do I want a drink.
Totally.
Well, competition.
Totally.
There you go.
Yeah, very much. Yeah.
Okay, right. There's three things I want to talk about before we finish this. One is the amazing ultra marathons that you and your love of comrades and the Una Gawaja stuff that you did, and you know, like that amazing story which kind of linked. And then I want to just talk about blind loyalty. So let's talk about your marathons and your love of distance running and putting yourself through what most people, even elite sports people, go, oh my, I could never do that. So tell us a story of all that.
So I've never been a runner until like this era of my life. I used to hate it. I remember I used to go running at Loughborough to try and get a bit fitter, because you can't be in a Loughborough squad if you're lazy bones. I mean, I hated it. But so I've never been a runner. But I remember after I was pregnant with Katie, who's your goddaughter, I was seriously overweight. I picked up 30 kilos and she popped out at 3 kilos. I remember the guy. The guy and he used to look at me every week going, you're probably eating for four there. And all the gumph that comes out, you know, after the pregnancy, after the birth. And then I got home and I was like 22 kilos overweight. And I'd been working with a personal trainer before I was pregnant. What, right up to birth, actually. You taught me. I was doing like shadow boxing and stuff. So we always expected Katie to pop out a boxer. And honestly, I was properly overweight. And I said, listen, I've got 6 months maternity leave. I need to lose every one of these 22 kilos before I go back to work. And he just went, you ain't got a chance, love, unless you start running. I was like, I can't run. So we had a treadmill and I literally started like 5 minute walk and then 5 minute walk, 1 minute run. And honest to God, it started like that. And I had so much respect for people who ran. I just was like, this is hell. And that's how most people feel about running, because it is hell. Even now, after doing ultra marathons, if I back off for 3 months, which doesn't happen anymore, but and you go back in for a 2k run, it's hell. Loyalty running's one of those things that is properly like unforgiving and properly rewarding. So basically I built myself up to a 10k, and then South Africa's got this extreme mentality, Robin, you and I have talked about this. You've said often you get recreational athletes coming in and they dream one day of running a half marathon, and maybe a lesser percentage dream of doing one marathon in their lifetime. South Africa is like, oh, you run marathons? Oh, that's cute. Yeah. That's the kind of attitude.
Yeah.
So, and that's because it's the home of the longest standing ultra marathon in the world. It's the most famous ultra marathon called Comrades. Anyway, before Comrades came onto my reckoning, I remember doing half marathons and enjoying them actually. And then out of the mouth of a babe, Hannah said to me, my daughter, Mom, why do you only do halves? Like, how far is a full? And I was 42 years old. And I said to her, it's 42 kilometers. She says, well, you need to do 42 kilometers while you're still 42. And that's how it started. So when your daughter says that, right, I kind of did stop and go, and this was in the April and my 43rd was in October. So I checked out the diary and I saw there was a marathon in September, Cape Town Marathon. And I trained for it. And that was my first marathon at the age of 42. And then as I was training for it, as soon as I got past the 25K mark, so when you train for your first 42, you typically, so obviously in the UK, you say 26.2, I think it is. You typically get up to about 30 kilometers. You don't have to go more than that. I mean, some people say you should. And as I got further into the training, when I ran the first 30K, I remember saying to my training buddy, "Oh, I'm going to do comrades." She just looked at me. We were dead. We were dead on our feet. It's the furthest we'd ever been. And she says, "But that's three times what we've just done." And I said, "I know. I just love it." So the first 42 I did, I remember getting to 41 kilometers, hardly any hassle at all. I go slow. Don't get me wrong. I'm a plodder. Like you did your marathons when you were a youngster. And I think you did them in half the time I do them. But I got to 41 kilometers and then I hit the wall. At 41, 1K to go. And I stopped and I said, "I can't do it." And she just looked at me and she'd had three or four meltdowns before we got there. And I pulled her through and I got there to 41 and she said, I said, "That's it. I can't do it." And she just looked at me. She said, "You're flipping kidding me." And then obviously I got past the line. And then I trained for comrades, which was not sensible because it was my first 42 in the September. And then I did a 56 ultra, which is called Two Oceans in April. And I was broken, a million tiny little pieces. And I put myself back together and then did comrades in the June. So in less than 9 months, I went from first 42 to comrades, which is not recommended. If I could look back, I should have taken a bit longer to get a bit more time on the legs.
To you. Let's dive in and have a go.
So, and then I just had the love for comrades. So what happens, anyone who's done comrades will know exactly what I'm talking about. It is called the ultimate human race. It is an emotional 12-hour cutoff. It cuts you off at 12 hours. You get people who've run for 12 hours and they're 12 hours, 1 second, and they don't complete comrades. The winner, the male winner, typically does it in like 5:20, I think. Female winner, 6 hours. So it's just an experience, but it's not just 90 kilometers. It's 90 kilometers through the most brutal hills of South Africa. And it was brought about by a gentleman called Vic Clapham, who wanted to honor the fallen comrades of the First World War. So it's got an incredible history. If anyone's interested in seeing how sport follows history, and actually, you know what? It brings together the very, very best of South Africans. South Africa is a complicated place, as you know, with a complicated political history and racial history. But on that start line of comrades, it doesn't matter what skin color you are, it doesn't matter what money you've got in the bank account, you're all standing there crying, singing the national anthem, singing Chariots of Fire, facing potentially 12 hours of pleasure and pain ahead of you. But if you've completed the Comrades Marathon, you've gone to a place that you will never regret.
Nobody else who doesn't do it will ever understand.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll never understand it and you'll never regret it.
It's beautiful. Yeah, enough said. No, listen. Absolutely. And I know how much you love it because you keep doing it. And I think when you did your first one, we were on the phone or we were waiting for updates off the air like every 20 minutes. Now, we don't even bother now. We're just like, "Oh, do another one." Yeah, yeah. Oh, really? Next. So that's, you've done that many.
I remember Mum got pissed off with me. She was like, "You're going to kill yourself." I was like, "Okay, well, then I'll die happy."
Just like you, huh? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Right. So I've got to talk about, look, the last couple of years for you, again, you've been to places that none of us could imagine. You sent me a message one Saturday morning, maybe, been swimming, rubbed my eye, something's not right. And then the story carries on from there. Look, I'll preempt it by saying it is the closest example from somebody that I know and love that of making the absolute best and more than the best out of a terrible situation or what appears to be a terrible situation. It's the archetypical story of this is a disaster that can ruin my life. And you, not single-handedly, but yes, single-handedly, because it's your decision that created that into something that's, we don't know how far it'll go in terms of the love and the benefits that it will bring. So let's talk about that story, which will lead us on to, I want to talk about your book before we finish. So tell us that story, man.
Yeah. So, Rob, I'm feeling quite emotional actually when you said that. On the 9th of March, in the, on the 8th of March last year, I had a normal day. I went for a run with my best mate. It was a birthday, and I went to bed at night. And on the 9th of March, in the middle of the night, I woke up and sat on the edge of the bed and scrunched my eye. And then the whole day, I was like, what's going on? Like this, ow, I've hurt my eye. Anyway, I just thought I'd overscratch my eye. Long story short, I had 3 months thereafter of the most terrifying ordeal of my life. So it properly, for the first time ever, I've been grounded to a halt. I was in bed for 3 months. I had this weird, rare and resistant fungus had made its way into my eye. We don't know where it's come from. We don't know how it happened, called Fusarium keratitis. And it took them a long time to find out what it was because your eye is not an easy thing to treat. So it took me a while to find the right surgeon because I didn't know where to go. I was with someone who then said, you need to see the best in the country, but I'm sorry, he's never available. He's so busy. And I was like, oh, great. And then eventually the best in the country said, sure, this is terrible. Let me help. And I got to see the doctor. He's going to remain anonymous. He hates being mentioned. So, long story short, I had this thing called Fusarium keratitis. In his career, he's a similar age to me. He's only treated four people, and he says, you're kind of up there at the top of the worst. In Europe alone last year, I think there were less than 100 cases. And basically, I had to have two emergency corneal transplants, corneas being flown in from Florida, organ donors. And he basically said he was preparing to have the discussion with me of how to give me a glass eye to save my eye. It was an eye-saving experience. But it wasn't that. The pain was so extreme, Rob. I used to phone you in tears, and I would eat a packet of Myprodol, which is like ibuprofen, a day. And like, I'm not a junkie kind of thing. I could not get rid of the pain. Eventually, he put me on Schedule 6 painkillers. He didn't want to because of the addiction to them. Within a week, I felt they were addictive. So I pulled myself off them. And within a week, this is what's so terrifying about painkillers. Within a week, I pulled myself off them. And I had withdrawal symptoms within a week of being on them. I was like, thank God I'm off these things. Like it was terrifying. So I learned a lot about all that kind of stuff. Eventually the pain went away because the second cornea transplant soft, I had internal drugs, I had injections in the eye. He tried everything to save my eye. But what happened at the end of it, the cornea transplant was a success, but my eye was destroyed inside, like destroyed. And I couldn't see a thing out of it, but I had extreme light sensitivity because the fungus had forced my pupil wide open. The iris was damaged. So I had to wear a patch for 14 months. So I kind of looked a bit like a pirate. It was my standard joke. And during all of this, I'm in South Africa, you either have private medical insurance or you don't. Like the NHS doesn't exist, for example. There is government medical care, but basically, in my case, what they would have done is not be able to treat me. So I would have screamed and shouted because the pain was so extreme and they would have cut my eye out. I'm not joking. So during all of this ordeal, whilst being covered by private medical care for a cornea to be flown over from Florida at the drop of a hat, there were certain drugs that I couldn't get under insurance that I had to find £5,000 for at the drop of a hat. Otherwise, this thing wasn't going away. So you just find a way, right? I don't know how, but we just found a way. We borrowed and we begged. And I just used to think to myself, what if I was someone in a township right now who is making good with my life for my kids and me, and this happened to me? Because there's no reason why it happened to me versus Tom, Dick, or Harry. And I used to talk to the doctor about it, and he said, yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. So he does a lot of pro bono work already, but he said he can't go as far as he needs to every time because he can cover his own time, but he can't cover the hard costs. So we collectively, but he, I kind of had to really say to him, come do this because you're already doing pro bono work. And he's terrified of the extra work because he's so busy. But as you said, don't, it's no extra work for you. I just need to harness your pro bono work. But find a way of funding the hard costs so that if someone is like me but can't afford you and can't afford the private cornea flown in from Florida, we have a trust that can. So we formed the Blind Loyalty Trust, the name I can give credit to my husband, Blind Loyalty. And through the trust, we raise funds through the loyalty industry. And through by doing it that way, we are able to fund. I've spent the first year of it. It's a bit less than a year now, finding enough funds to be able to now start to offer the surgery I don't do the surgery, obviously. The doctor does. And we're now finding the right patients to help. He's got a list of folks he knows needs help. It has to be in the corneal transplant. That's where his expertise. And there's no shortage of people who need help. So the reason we've not gone ahead, even though we've got enough money, is what if they're a problem patient like me? You can't just have enough money to do one of the transplants. What if they need three? So we've had to make sure we've collected a crap load of money before we can take on a patient, because you can't abandon a patient midway.
Yeah, halfway through.
So yeah, exactly. So that's what the Blind Loyalty Trust does. But I'm not begging for money, although a lot of people generously donated to support me running Comrades this year with one eye. But I've basically created a force of movement with the loyalty industry. So in the loyalty industry, for example, if any of you know anything about loyalty or use loyalty programs, you have a pot of points possibly in your loyalty program, and you can either spend those points on 20 quid off at Tesco's or whatever, or a lot of these companies donate points to charity. So a lot of the way I'm trying to raise funds globally and locally in South Africa is to persuade those companies to give the choice of donating your points to Blind Loyalty. So the points pay for the real money that comes into the trust. So you as a user might go, sure, this charity is about blindness and my granny died and she was blind and it was miserable. I'm going to give my points to charity. And it's actually much more sustainable than going knocking on the door saying, can you give 100 quid towards this charity? We also do other cool stuff like create nice bracelets and the profit from them go to the trust. And there's other ways we make money, but that's kind of the thrust of it. And we're now in a position where we're ready to start the procedures. So
you must be so pleased at that. So proud of that, man. Got to be.
I can't wait, though, to meet. I can't wait. I can't imagine the emotion I'm going to feel when we meet the first people who we save. Yeah. So because I promise you, living with impaired sight is properly crap. It's like, it's awful. You know, I used to bump into I had one eye that worked. So even just with one eye out was, and I say was because I've had further surgery, and this doctor I'm talking about is a magician. He has taken away all the cataracts. I mean, cataract surgery is common, it's not complicated, so that was the easy part. But he had to rebuild my eye entirely. He's put in a new lens. He's just can't believe actually that the back of my eye was never damaged because the fungus was so bad. And now I can see, it's just a miracle. I'm not wearing the patch anymore. So he can't believe, he can believe it because he believed in himself, but he knew a million things could have gone wrong and it didn't. And I'm so grateful. I'm so eternally grateful to him. And yeah, it's one of those stories that if you told me this 2 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it can happen to anyone, let alone me. And then in the middle of it, if you told me that you will actually be able to see next August or September, I would have gone, how is that possible? But it is. So for all of us out there, whatever your medical situation is, and also, sorry, just before I say that, what I was about to say then, I'm really healthy. Like I look after myself. I run ultramarathons. And you know this, Rob, we were trying to do some work together, which required us collectively to sign a life policy. I suddenly went from being the healthiest person, one of the healthiest people I know, to someone who you couldn't even get a life policy on. They wouldn't touch me. Yeah, and that's you know, so suddenly none of us can take our health for granted, because I woke up on the 9th of March last year and my life changed dramatically. So I have lost the train of thought what I was going to say before that, but it doesn't matter. Our health is important, but you actually are not actually always in control of it. And 100%. If you're not, good things can still come out of the most dire situation. And actually, the irony is, and I know you said you wanted to talk about the book, the irony is because I couldn't bear light. So even the lowest setting of light on your phone, when I was in that 3 month darkness, metaphorically and literally, all I could do is listen to audiobooks. So I listened to a load of audiobooks, and then I got fed up of listening to all this self-motivation. I was like, enough now. I just need some light distraction. And then I've been meaning to write a book on loyalty for 10 years, probably. And all my colleagues every year, when I set my goals, you know, we set the goals in January, they go, is your book on your list? And I go, yeah. And then instead of getting up to write my book, I used to get up and run and train for Comrades. So the book always got trumped by Comrades training. Yeah. And then eventually I got to a point where I was like, who wants to read a book on loyalty? What's the point? Like, honestly, who wants to read a book on loyalty? I'm in loyalty and I don't want to read a book on loyalty. That's how I used to think. So I kind of put it off and kind of almost wrote it off. And then it came to me in the darkness of how I needed to write this book on loyalty. And that's what I've done. So it came to me that instead of writing a book on loyalty, I was going to write this concept of just take, because loyalty is complicated for marketing professionals. It isn't that easy unless you kind of break it down into component parts. So I've broken it down into 101 component parts, and it's called Blind Loyalty, 101 Loyalty Concepts Radically Simplified. Because at Truth, we radically simplify the complexity of loyalty for our clients. So we've got a 2 pages per 101 concepts, no more. And I asked a lot of people to contribute to the book, professionals around the world who I believe are much more experienced in the deeper, in a particular niche part of loyalty. Mm-hmm. And it was really hard for them to keep it to less than 2 pages. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's now ready. It's alive and yeah.
It's on Amazon?
Not quite yet. I'm still in that process. So it's on amandacromhote.com. The digital and the audio book, and the physical book is still in South Africa. So obviously the next stage will be for me to get physical books on Amazon and so forth. But amandacromhote.com is where you can find any stuff about me, but the book, and on a digital and audio version. And more importantly, sorry, the proceeds of the book, all the profit from the book go to the trust.
Beautiful.
So I don't personally benefit 1 cent from it other than seeing my face on the front of a book, maybe seeing it in the bookstore. But no, 100% of the profits go to the trust.
Wow, beautiful. So we've traversed the positives and not so many negatives, many of the positives of how an early life kind of made you be a jumper in and fake it till you make it and give it a go, to grabbing all opportunities that stepped across your path, to be an understanding, have an understanding mind about when it's time to move or jump or swim or change direction, to embracing what you love, particularly with your ultra marathons, and having an understanding of what you're good at and digging deep into that so that you can follow kind of all what you were given by the universe, and making the most of all our gifts, which is a common theme. And I think you do that so well. And just, you know, ending up with turning a terrible challenge or a beautiful challenge into an amazing ending that hasn't ended yet, but has got kind of a conclusion to it. So here's to the next bit, sis.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks.
That's why I wanted you on the podcast. So
that's a privilege.
Thank you for sharing your life with us, and being able to share it with the listeners as well as keeping it to myself. So
no, Rob, it's an absolute privilege. You and I spend hours and hours talking about philosophy and the meaning of life, so it's great to actually formalize it a little bit. So thank you. It's a real privilege.